Hi, welcome to Module 5 of SQL Server for Oracle DBAs. In this module, we will look at the various data access methods, and we will compare Transact SQL to PL SQL as a programming language for the database. We will also perform a discussion of a transactional management concept and how transaction management differs between Oracle and SQL Server. We'll also briefly talk about error handling and look at the way SQL Server Query Optimizer works. So first of all, let me briefly discuss the components inside the relational engine. We have already discussed the SQL OS and the role of SQL OS in providing all the functionality for scalability on various platforms. So SQL OS is responsible for managing resources and executing our threads on the CPU. Now, what we are interested in this module are the query components and the execution engine. So when your query comes into the server, it goes through a number of steps. It first needs to be parsed, then optimized, and then finally compiled. This process can be very expensive, and the component responsible for that is Query Optimizer. So once you have your once your query has been optimized and compiled, you're ready to execute, and you will execute your query using Query Execution Engine, talking to the storage engine for data retrieval. Let's take a look at Transact SQL as a programming language and the querying facilities it offers. So let's first start by discussing SQL as a structured query language. Structured query language is an ANSI standard that is implemented to various degrees by various vendors. Both Oracle and SQL Server implement so-called entry-level SQL 92 standard. They also support some core features of SQL 2008. In addition to that, each platform has a set of its own proprietary extensions that are unique to each of the products. However, the core of the programming language, the core of the structured query language, is the same on both platforms as it comes from the ANSI standard. Various SQL statements can be categorized into data definition language, or DDL, where you create and define your objects, so creating a table, creating an index, altering a stored procedure. All those are data definition language. Then we have data manipulation language, or DML. These are statements used to create, update, retrieve, and delete your data. In addition to those, we also have transaction control statements, so controlling the scope of your transaction, starting, rolling back, committing your transactions. We have session control statements, where you set certain options on your session, on your connection, and system control statements, so controlling and configuring your server. Let's start by looking at the data definition language, or DDL. DDL is used to define and alter your database schema. You generally you use create, alter, and drop statements. DDL also involves access controls, so granting permissions on your objects, granting and revoking permissions to your objects that is found in both platforms, but also deny that is only found in SQL Server and has no equivalent in Oracle. The reason we have deny explicit deny permission in SQL Server is that the SQL Server security model is somewhat more complicated. And in addition to individual users, you can also have users that represent groups. for instance, an entire Windows group that is granted access to your database. If you want to grant access and permission to a particular object to all the developers, except for maybe Joe, because Joe should not have access to that object, then you can grant permission to the group, but then single out Joe and revoke permission, deny permission to Joe. Deny permission always takes precedence over any granted permissions. We will discuss some of those, security features in the next module. When it comes to creating your objects, a very important difference between Oracle and SQL Server are the rules for identifiers. Oracle allows object identifiers up to 30 characters, where SQL Server allows identifiers up to 128 Unicode characters. Also, object identifiers in Oracle are always case insensitive. They're actually converted to uppercase and stored in the database catalog in uppercase. SQL Server preserves the case of the original name or the original identifier with which the object was created. Whether or not your object name will be case sensitive or not depends on the settings on the server and the settings of whether the server was created with or installed with the case sensitive code page. If your server is installed with a case sensitive code page, your object names will be case sensitive. But the default behavior is that the object names are not case sensitive. However, the casing of your object names is preserved. When it comes to data manipulation language, both SQL Server and Oracle, of course, offer the same CRUD statements. So create, retrieve, update, and delete. There are, of course, small differences between Oracle and SQL Server when it comes to syntax and how you express your queries. Some of those differences, an example of such difference, can be, for instance, the fact that Oracle only allows 1,000 values in the in clause, whereas SQL Server does not have an explicit limit for the number of values contained in the in clause of your query. There's, of course, an implicit limit in the amount of resources that are available in order to run, compile and run your query. There are also other syntax variations. For instance, Oracle offers a string concatenation operator using the double pipe operator. In SQL Server, the string concatenation operator is a plus sign. So it's the same as the addition operator. Basically, the operator in SQL Server is overloaded, and the meaning of the operator depends on what are the operands. So in this example here, we have field 3 and field 4. If those two fields are strings, for instance, varchars, that syntax means string concatenation. However, if those fields were numeric or, for instance, integers, this syntax would mean numeric addition. So it depends on what are the operands. These are some of the examples of small syntax differences between Oracle and SQL Server. Let me show you a few simple transact SQL queries that we run against our database. So let's start by running a simple three-table query. We are joining person with salesperson and with sales territory to retrieve the sales quota for all the people in sales territory within the US. We want basically all our salespeople with top five salespeople with the highest sales quota within the US. And that is the list. As you can see, the the syntax, the join syntax is the same in Oracle and SQL Server, since it's based on the ANSI standard. Another example is using local variables. So in this example, I have two variables, begin date and end date, and I use them in running my query. So I will retrieve only the sales orders from that particular date range. Unfortunately, there are no rows within that range, so maybe we should increase that range to have more data. And here we are. These are the rows that fulfill that criteria. Notice that I didn't change the syntax for the query. I just changed the variable that was used inside the query. SQL Server also allows for so-called row constructors. And row constructors can be used to insert, for instance, multiple rows in a single statement. So I create a table called Rockstar, and I insert four Rockstars into this table by using a single insert statement. This syntax where I have multiple rows specified, separated by a comma, is called row constructors. And as you can see, four rows affected, so I inserted four rows in a single shot. Another example of a slightly more complicated query is this. In this query, we are using a with keyword to define so-called common table expression. You can think of common table expression as a type of ad hoc view definition. So it is like a view, except it doesn't really exist in your database schema as a permanent view. This query, this named query or named subquery, is defined ad hoc. So basically I say V1 is my query here, and based on this query, I would like to run another query on top of that V1 subquery. So I'm referencing the common table expression name in my main query. And I'm using an interesting syntax called grouping sets, where I perform grouping of my rows, not using one set of columns, by actually using three different set of columns. So for the data coming from my fact internet sales, I want to perform grouping by the region, week, and day. So I want to aggregate the total sales amount by region, by week, by the day. Then just by the region, without including week and day. And then finally, I have an empty grouping set that means calculate the grand total. So I essentially perform three different types of grouping in a single query. And the option max DOP 1 at the end of the query indicates that I don't want this query to be executed in parallel. I want this query to be executed using a single thread. So let's execute the query and see the results that we will get. So as you can see, this query aggregated the data by region, week, and the day, but it also created additional rows for grand total within the region, as well as the overall grand total for all regions. So using this query, I have performed three groupings in a single query. So this was an example of some simple Transact SQL queries that we may execute in our database. We will later look at the execution plans for those queries and see how the query optimizer decides to execute them. Let's now take a look at the control statements. SQL Server offers both transaction and session and system control similar to Oracle, however, using a different syntax. So, for instance, alter system is typically performed by using spconfigure, and alter database can be performed either by using spdb option or by using alter database statements. Many of the operations in when it comes to system and session control can be performed in more than one way and using more than one syntax type. We will talk in detail about the transaction control in just a few moments, but as you can see, there are the same commit, rollback, and save transaction statements. When it comes to procedural programming in SQL Server, both Oracle and SQL Server use the begin and end to group multiple statements into single unit and use if conditions for conditional execution. SQL Server, unlike Oracle, offers only one type of loop. So where Oracle offers loop, for, and while, SQL Server offers only the while loop. However, it does not really create much of a problem, as all the functionality can be implemented using the while loop. When it comes to building and executing dynamic SQL statements, Oracle offers DMS SQL and execute immediate. Oracle SQL Server offers SP execute SQL as well as execute statements. Now, the difference between execute and SP execute SQL is that execute allows you to execute a literal string for your query, where SP execute SQL allows you to build a parameterized query with a parameter placeholders, and using SP execute SQL, you can define what those parameters are and provide values. So you can execute parameterized queries, which allows for and enhances the execution plan reuse, as you can reuse the same execution plan for multiple queries independently of the actual parameter values. Both SQL Server and Oracle also offer cursors for row-by-row processing of your data. SQL Server has a number of different cursors, static, dynamic, key set. Your cursors can be read-only or read-write. However, one important difference between Oracle and SQL Server, an important thing for an Oracle DBA who starts to use SQL Server to remember, is that in SQL Server, the penalty, the overhead of using cursors is much higher than in Oracle. People coming from the Oracle background have a tendency of using cursors for great many operations. And it performs well in Oracle. It might not perform as well in SQL Server. So in SQL Server, we pay more attention to avoiding cursors whenever possible and using set-based operations instead, as set-based operations are generally much more efficient in relational databases. Please keep that in mind when moving your code from Oracle to SQL Server. If you get a chance, try to avoid using cursors in SQL Server and use set-based operations instead. We also have full-text capabilities in both Oracle and SQL Server. It is very often now that you store large text documents inside a database and you want to perform flexible full-text search against those documents, finding documents that contain a particular keyword. So the The database model itself, the relational database model itself, does not offer this type of functionality. Both Oracle and SQL Server have extensions that allow you to create full text indexes. And as you can see, the simplest syntax using contains function is actually very similar. Now, SQL Server builds those full text indexes and stores them with inside the database. They're stored in the database just like any other index in your database. However, they are actually populated by a separate process, so they are not maintained the same way as any other relational index. There is a slight delay between the moment you put the data or update the data into a table and the moment where that change is reflected into your full text search. Full text indexes are maintained using different mechanisms from those that maintain your normal relational indexes. When it comes to development tools for SQL Server and for Oracle, as you already know, SQL Server offers Management Studio as the integrated administration and development tool. So it can be used to both administer your SQL Server, perform object creations, and write your stored procs, but it can also be used to tune and debug queries. So that's the most important and most often used tool for querying the database. SQL Server 2012 also offers SQL Server data tools that come with Visual Studio. In addition to that, you have command line querying tools, and where in Oracle you have SQL Plus, you have SQL CMD in SQL Server. It allows you to execute queries using scripts against any SQL Server instance. Apart from the tools that are provided with the product, there are of course many third-party tools available on the market for both Oracle and SQL Server. Some of those tools can actually handle both platforms at the same time and can be used to program against SQL Server and Oracle in the same manner. When it comes to error handling, SQL Server has two ways of handling errors. In T-SQL, we can either use the @@error function, which is the legacy way of handling errors, or we can use the try-catch functionality, which is the new preferred way of handling errors. It is analogous to that in any other programming language that offers try-catch functionality. Oracle has many predefined system exceptions and error messages, and so does SQL Server. So SQL Server has internal predefined error messages that are stored in the sysmessages catalog view. And those error messages have various severity levels. And the table on the slide describes the severity levels of SQL Server error messages. So essentially anything below 10 is an informational only message. Technically it's an error message, but it's not really an error message and does not indicate any problem. It might be just the information about how our queries are executed. Anything between 11 and 16 indicates an error that can be fixed by the user. So for instance, a syntax error or constraint violation would be an error that you can fix yourself, or the user can fix yourself by fixing, for instance, the data that he wants to insert into a table. Errors between 17 and 19 are errors that indicate various software problems in the database engine, something that cannot be fixed by a user. So some kind of an error during execution. You know, the query failed, for instance, because of data corruption. And 20 to 25 indicate very severe fatal errors and will generally terminate the connection to the server. So connection that which triggered that error will be terminated. And in some extreme cases, the server process itself may also terminate. That is, of course, not very often. It would only happen in case of some very serious data corruption. Both SQL Server and Oracle also allow you to create your own custom error messages. So you can predefine application error messages and then use them in your code, in your procedures, for instance, to indicate various types of problems. In SQL Server, you use race error or throw statements to create or generate error messages. Now, when it comes to query optimization, SQL Server offers a cost-based optimizer, just like Oracle does. SQL Server does not have a rule-based optimizer similar to the rule-based optimizer found in some versions of in some of the older versions of Oracle. So all the query optimization in SQL Server is performed using cost-based optimizer. Execution plans and decisions made during optimization are generally based on data distribution statistics found in your database. So the query optimizer will read the schema of the database to discover what is the schema of the table that you're querying, what are the indexes that are available. It will also read in the statistics for those indexes, trying to understand how many rows will take part in your query. For instance, how many rows will fulfill a particular criteria found in the work loss of your query. And based on the number of rows and the size of the data that will be flying, that will be processed by each of the operators in your execution plan, query optimizer in SQL Server decides what is the best way to execute the query. And the most important decisions that it makes decide on the access method used to retrieve data from the table, so whether we will perform an index seek or an index scan, which index we will use, etc. And order and algorithm used for joining tables. So in which order we will join the tables, will we join them using nested loops or merge join or any other algorithm. There are three algorithms, by the way, available in SQL Server. So those decisions made by the query optimizer will affect your performance. Those decisions are based on the estimation of the number of rows taking part in your query. Those estimations and the guess about the number of rows taking part of your query is based on those data distribution statistics. So it is very important to have your data distribution statistics present and up to date in order for the query optimizer to be able to make the right choice. If you want to see the way your query is being executed by SQL Server, in Oracle you can use Explain Plan, and in SQL Server the easiest way is to use the graphical execution plan found in Management Studio. There are actually many ways to retrieve execution plan from SQL Server. You can retrieve any execution plan that is found in the execution plan cache. You can retrieve it an XML document that describes what the plan is, and the Management Studio is smart enough to recognize this piece of XML as describing the execution plan and display it in a graphical, easy-to-read way. Let me show you an example. So in this example, in this demo, we will look at the execution plans for some of the queries we have executed earlier. We will see how those plans are being executed and what are the query optimizer estimations on the number of rows that will take part in our query. So let's go to back to my first query where I queried for top five salespeople in US region. The easiest way to retrieve the execution plan is to include the actual execution plan when executing the query. Another alternative, if you don't want to execute the query, is to see display estimated execution plan. This option just performs the optimization of your plan, of your query, and displays the plan that would be used to execute the query, but it doesn't actually execute the query. Of course, in this case, we can include the actual execution plan and execute my query to see if the query optimizer got the estimates right and if the number of rows that was estimated matches the number of rows that is actually present in my query. So if I execute this query, apart from the results, I also get this extra tab called execution plan. And this is a graphical execution plan for my query. It shows the various operators that will be used to access data from the three tables that take part in my query. You always read your execution plans from right to left and from top to bottom. So the first operator that executes is this clustered index scan. And as you can see, I can get a lot more information about this operator when I point at it with my mouse cursor. So what we can see here is that the estimated number of rows in the query was 17, and the actual number of rows retrieved from the index was 17. So the query optimizer knew exactly how many rows will come out from this table. The next operator that is executed is the sort. So essentially, we read all the data from the salesperson table, and we sort it by sales quota. So we immediately perform the sorting that is needed for our query. And as you can see, in this case, we have estimated number of rows 13 and the actual number of rows 9. So we only retrieved 9 rows out of this sort. By the way, the thickness of the arrows in the execution plan indicate the number of rows that might be flowing from one operator to the other. So in this case, we have 17 rows coming out of the clustered index scan, but only 9 rows returned by the sort. That's the reason for that, of course, is that we have the top clause in my query, so we don't need all the rows from each sales territory. We just need the top five. Then, next, we perform a nested loop join with another table. So we perform a clustered index scan to find any matching rows within the sales territory table. The way it is actually executed is that for each row coming in here, we execute that clustered index scan. That's why if you look at the estimated number of executions and actual number of executions, you can see that the estimated number of executions was 11 and the number of executions was 9. Since we had 9 rows coming into the join, we've also performed this clustered index scan 9 times, once for each outer table row, so basically for the row that comes in here. Once we have the results of that join, those results are fed into another join, and this time we only have 5 rows because we already filtered out by the country region code US. So we no longer need all the rows. We only need the rows for US. And we get the top five rows for US. And we retrieve information from the person table for those 5 rows. So we retrieve the first name, as you can see from the output list here. We are retrieving the first name and the last name for each of those sales people. The percentages here at the bottom of each operator indicate the relative cost of this operator as compared to the cost of the entire query. So we can see that actually almost half of the cost of execution for this query is in our sort operator. That sort is very expensive, despite the fact that it only sorts 9 rows. So that's an example of an execution plan for a 3-table query. We can also take a look at another example, this time slightly more complicated since we are using CTE and we are using grouping sets. And this is an example of somewhat more complicated execution plan. You still read it right to left and top to bottom. So what happens here is this clustered index scan is performed first. It is fed into a hash match join, and that hash match join uses the results of another join as its other input. So we are performing 3 table scans essentially, because the clustered index scan is the same as a table scan. We perform 3 table scans and join those 3 tables using hash match joins. And once again, it turns out that one of the most expensive operators in our query is the sort operator that sorts our data by week and year. These are some of the examples of execution plans, graphical execution plans that can be retrieved from our database engine. So that's how you know how your query is being executed, and that's one of the fundamental tools in performing query optimization. Whenever you want to understand how the query is performed and perform troubleshooting for optimization, you very often look at the execution plan, looking at what are the most costly, most expensive operators there. If we are performing any table scans, can we avoid those table scans by maybe creating indexes? So this is a very important query optimization and performance tuning tool. We will talk more about query optimization in one of the later modules, and we will then discuss how the query how we can affect the choices being made by the query optimizer. The next topic I would like to discuss here is the transaction management. Generally, in Oracle, you are responsible for committing and rolling back your transactions explicitly. But the transactions are created for you. You don't have to start the transaction using begin transaction statement. The transaction starts for you whenever you start modifying the data. And you have to remember to commit that transaction using an explicit commit or rollback statement. Now, in SQL Server, there is an equivalent behavior called implicit transactions. It is not very often used by the SQL Server developers, but it's often used to provide compatibility or similar behavior to the one found in Oracle. So using implicit transactions in SQL Server, you will have the same behavior as in Oracle, with the transaction starting implicitly and developer or the DBA being responsible for explicitly committing that transaction. In addition to this method, we have the explicit transactions. So in SQL Server, you can define explicit transactions by marking the starting point of your transaction using begin transaction and then committing or rolling back your transaction later. And we also have a so-called auto-commit mode, which is the default behavior. And it's based on committing every statement as the statement completes. So in SQL Server, if you don't explicitly identify where your transaction starts and where it ends, you will have each statement as its own separate transaction. If I perform 10 inserts one by one, each insert, if it completes successfully, is committed as its own separate transaction. Now, if what I really wanted was to execute all those 10 inserts as a single transaction, I would have to start with an explicit begin transaction, insert, 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 commit transaction. Of course, don't forget the error handling there as well. That, of course, will also improve performance because committing one transaction is cheaper and more performant than committing 10 individual transactions for each row inserted. Now, in SQL Server, you can also perform distributed transactions. Distributed transactions are most often used when you run transaction that spans multiple instances of SQL Server or generally multiple data sources. Whenever you perform a cross-database transaction within a single instance of SQL Server, it is technically a distributed transaction, but because there is only one instance of SQL Server involved, and therefore there is only one resource manager, all the transaction handling is performed internally, and there is no need to start distributed transaction and use the distributed transaction coordinator. So there is no need to perform a two-phase commit using DTC. However, if your transaction spans multiple instances of SQL Server, so if you query from database on one instance and update data to on another instance of SQL Server, that will be a distributed transaction that requires a distributed transaction coordinator and two-phase commit. So in this module, we have looked at the basics of structured query language and the ways you can create your queries and run your queries against the database. We have also looked at some differences in transaction handling between Oracle and SQL Server, and we've discussed the graphical execution plans and the cost-based optimizer in SQL Server. We will talk about some of those topics in more detail in the second part of this training. Now, thank you very much for watching, and I encourage you to watch module number 6, where we will discuss security and transaction isolation for data protection. Thank you.